That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Hey, welcome to the latest That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. So excited to have my buddy Ramona Shelburne on the show today. And we had a very long and very intriguing conversation about how she got started, the questions she had about what she wanted to do with her life when she was in her early 20s, how she became the dynamo reporter that she is. And then we really got into the weeds on being a newsbreaker and creating relationships with people and sources. I'm fascinated by that. When I don't have a legitimate journalist background, I consider myself a sort of entertainer who dabbles in journalism, but having not done the full masters and having not done I did a little bit of beat reporting, but not a ton. I just wanted to pick her brain. How do you get people to reveal things to you that they won't tell anyone else? How do you get people to trust you and give you information and go back and forth when it suits them and when it suits you? So we really dove deep on that, and I think you'll find it fascinating. She's such an interesting and honest and genuine person. So I'm not going to blabber on any longer because we blabber enough in this, and I want you guys to get a chance to hear from her. And after my interview with Ramona, a very quick blog post from way back when, back, when I was in my early 20s that Ramona reminded me of that I think you'll probably get a laugh at. So here's the interview with Ramona.
That's what she said.
More That's What She Said coming up in just a second. But first, I want to remind you that I want to hear from you. If you're new to the podcast or even if you've been listening for a long time, I want to know what you're thinking. How am I doing? Do you like my guests? Do you like the topics? So let me know who you'd like to hear from or things you want to change, things that you love. If you're listening in Apple Podcasts, you can leave me a rating and a review. And if you like what you hear, you can make sure you're subscribed so that I'm easier to find for you next time. And if you subscribe to That's What She Said in the ESPN app, we can send you an alert whenever we have a new episode. So that's exciting. You can always also tweet me your thoughts at Sarah Spain on Twitter. We'd love to hear from you.
That's what she said.
So happy to be joined by my buddy Ramona Shelburne. I'm sure you know who she is, but I like to list off her many accomplishments. NBA insider, senior writer for ESPN, ESPN The Mag writer, ESPNW writer, regular contributor on shows across ESPN networks like The Jump, Around the Horn, Outside the Line, Sports Nation, NBA Tonight. Formerly of ESPN Los Angeles and has worked her way up into basically running the entire company and earning incredible accolades along the way. So I'm excited to talk to you because usually when we chat, it's either, you know, outside of work, just life stuff, or on the air when I've got something very specific to ask you about, you know, some breaking news or some issue that's going on. And I really want to dive into more like big level ideas about how you became who you are and how you do your job, because I'm fascinated by it. But I want to start at the beginning. So let's start with when you were a kid. What did you want to be when you grew up?
Okay. So I guess I was one of those kids who would see movies and be like, I want to be that. So there was a little time I was like, I want to be Indiana Jones. And then I wanted to be CJ Craig from The West Wing. Like, I had that little, like, fantasy, right?
Okay, all right.
Okay. I don't know. I went off to college and, like, I really didn't know. I really didn't know at all what I wanted to do. And then I guess, like, sophomore, junior year, I was sort of like, oh, you know what? Like, I probably should, like, pick a major and pick a job. And so I just started out, like, going to the Stanford Daily and saying, like, hey, can I write for you? And they were like, sure, you don't get paid anything, and the only beats we have now are, like, men's golf or, like, something that I knew nothing about. And so I just kind of, like, started there, and I was playing softball, so I didn't really have a lot of time to be traveling or going to games or whatever it was. And, like, I think the first year or two I would I mostly wrote about, like, the men's golf team, and the coach would always be like, oh, the wind was really tough today, and that's why I was like, I didn't know enough to know that the wind is, like, always tough when you play golf, clearly.
Right, right.
So I would write these very dramatic stories. And I just kind of wrote it, and I just did in and around when I was playing softball, so I wasn't all that committed to it, but I knew that I had to have a job at some point. And, like, it just kind of said, well, I like sports, and I used to read the paper all the time in LA, so those two things go together. And I can write, and I can, you know, talk my way through most situations, right? So it was, like, a good place to start. But I spent a lot of time thinking I was going to have a complete, like, this was a place to start. And, like, this was just because it felt easy in a way. Like I like sports. I like talking. I like doing this. And then I realized, like, oh, that's actually, like, everybody's dream is to have a job that they just like doing.
Right.
Right. And that feels easy to you. And so even though it is work, like, there'll be times that I'm stressed and busy and all that stuff, but I actually get to have a really fun, cool job all the time. And whenever I get to that other stage, I just remind myself of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it can be crazy and there's not a lot of consistency on a day-to-day basis, which is what I like about it. And then what can sometimes be frustrating. So did you play any other sports besides softball?
Yeah, I was in high school. I mean, like I played soccer and basketball and my basketball, I always like to say I have Rajon Rondo game.
Okay.
Don't really shoot very well. Pretty decent handle, kind of a bad attitude.
Okay, I like that. All right. I can't see you having a bad attitude. I mean, I can see you throwing some bows and getting what you need.
Oh, yeah.
But I can't see you having a bad attitude, like teammate or coach wise. okay. I like this side of Ramona.
Yeah, he's a little feisty.
Okay.
I think I complain a lot. I was a foul, man.
I had some of that myself.
Side of me.
Okay.
And when I was yes, I know you do. when I was growing up, my brother and I would play video games, and there got to be a point where I was not allowed to play anymore because
competitiveness.
How frustrated I would get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've got that.
Yeah.
I have to be very careful in playing even drunken board games with friends because I need to win everything. And if you disappoint me and you're not competitive enough and bring in your A game, I will be mad. And I have to be okay, we're just hanging out. Relax, Spain. Get it together.
Yeah.
But your competitiveness served you well because you ended up at Stanford. You were a 3-time academic All-American in softball. You were on the first Stanford team to make the NCAA tournament. And the Women's College World Series that you played alongside Jess Mendoza. So you're a baller. You're a legit badass baller.
I would say, was I good enough to start and play on the team? Yes. In terms of if we look at percentage of players, what percentile would I have been in of my age cohort? Probably pretty high, right? But really my best contribution to the Stanford team was helping to recruit Jessica Mendoza.
Okay, first of all, I need to hear that story. But this is my theory on this. Is the best athletes don't have to tell you how great they are because it's implied.
Right.
I just said that you were on a tremendous Stanford team that was that great.
Yep.
And so you downplay it. You know, when people ask me, I like to be I was the captain and I had the school record for a little bit because I wasn't that great. And I was, I was good at pretty much every sport. I wasn't amazing at anything. So I have to say that to convince people, no, I used to be a good athlete. I promise. Whereas you don't have to. You can downplay it, which tells me exactly what I need to know, which means you were a baller.
Yeah.
All right. Very briefly, tell me the story of recruiting Jess Mendoza because I do want to get to you and not talk about Jess, but I want to hear the story.
I know. It's a good story. So I'm 1 year older than Jess, and I always used to play up. And so all the girls that I played with on my travel team, they all went up to college my senior year, and then I had to go down and play on her team. And because she was, 1 year younger. So this is, I met her, and I was I'd heard about her, but I didn't know her until I played on her team. So this is my senior year. This is when Stanford's recruiting me, other schools, I'm deciding where to go. And I finally meet Mendoza, and I was Stanford would come to watch me. And I'm not saying I was this really hard recruit for them to get. It was more me saying, hey, I really want to go there. Would you take me that? I remember my coach came out 3 or 4 times, and Jessica knew that Stanford was recruiting me, and she was like, "Really? That's my dream school." And so I mostly just spent the whole time telling the Stanford coach, "Hey, this Mendoza girl I'm playing with is the best player I've ever seen in my life. She says she wants
already
to go to Stanford.
Already reporting. Already giving scoops. Getting the inside info.
He's like, "Really?" Yeah, and people knew who she was, but they didn't know who she was yet. And I was I'm telling you, I've never seen anybody so good. She's amazing at everything. She really wants to go to Stanford, though. So I think at that time, Stanford wasn't that good. They were 500. We were still kind of converting over from being a club sport. And if you were going there, you're going there because it was Stanford. It was you want to get a great education. It wasn't because they were some big softball powerhouse. So I don't know that we would have taken Jessica wanting to go to Stanford as seriously unless I would have told him she really wants to go there. Cause she was could have gone to anywhere, all the top 10 schools, all that. But because they knew, so she comes and she goes on
they
a recruiting
trip. Pushed hard.
Trip,
Yeah.
And it was
I love this. I love this. Just breaking news, getting the scoop, helping the team out. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're at Stanford. You are getting a master's in communication and a bachelor's in American studies. So did the master's come after, or are you like Jess Mendoza, crazy overachiever, where you managed to do all that in 4 years?
Yeah, I did that in 4 years.
What's wrong with you people? Is this
no,
a
you know
thing
what? I
at Stanford? I'm so confused.
Yeah, see, the thing is, if you go to Stanford, they want you to succeed. Like, I'm not saying it's easy or anything, but it's like they want you to succeed. Like, you have to try to fail, okay? And so, like, they want you to go get a master's, too, because that's going to make you more successful in life. And that's going to make you – and, like, when other people do it, it makes you want to do it, right?
So you graduated in 3 years? Is that what it is? You took 3 years for your bachelor's, and then your master's is just a one-year program?
Yeah, my last year was that. And it was kind of weird because they – I didn't realize – I actually – signed up for the journalism program, and I was supposed to do like that my last year. That was an actual graduate program, and you have to like have your degree and all that. But then they promised me that there were classes in the morning, and I was like, you know, I'm on the softball team, right? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, well, I have to take morning classes, and they promised that there would be, and then there just weren't. And so I had to switch over to media studies communication, which is actually a co-term, so I didn't actually have to graduate. So it was a little, like, I ended up in grad housing with, like, a roommate I didn't know, and she was, like, way older than me in my last year. And I was like, what did I do? I really should have, like, researched this better before.
Right. I mean, your senior year wasn't a typical senior year. Right. And I would imagine your junior year wasn't either, because just because you had to double up and move faster to get done early. So you never really got to.
I should have been coasting.
Yeah. Would you say that later in life you figured out how to make up for lost time, or do you think you've never really let go like we all did senior year of college?
Yeah, I think I figured out how to let go, because now my way of really unplugging is to just leave the country where it's very hard to get a hold of me. Like,
it's kind of like, give me, like, the only way to do it now.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is, like, you know, people will be like, oh, you're always on your phone, and, you know, why don't you turn your phone off when you're on vacation? And I'm like, you know what, it's kind of like, I used to get guilty about that and feel like, oh, I should, this means that I'm not, like, a well-adjusted person, and now I'm just like, no, you know what? This is like, it means I actually like what I do for a job. And, you know, I put a lot of time into relationships and making things work. And so when people do call you and, like, you know, all the time that you invest in things, but if something happens while I happen to be, like, on a beach in Greece or something, I don't really want to handle it right then, but I'm going to be mad if, like, something happens that I, you know, worked hard to get and I don't want to lose it because I'm on a beach in Greece.
Right.
So,
well, and there's, like, you know, okay. It's a job that takes up a ton of time, and you don't have nights and weekends the same way, and you don't put it to bed when you leave the office, but you get to be doing something you love even when you're working, and you get it affords you a lot of incredible opportunities in life. So it's a real balance that I think we all need to figure out what ours is. I would argue that there are people like maybe you and certainly Schefter who aren't really able to shut it off. And that can be a blessing and a curse. And maybe later in life you decide you want a better balance. But now you're just like straight hustle mode. And that's gotten you really far. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's also like there's levels of like turning it off. There's levels of shutting off. Right. Like, so I would say, like, you know, when you're okay, I don't know if you meditate or anything, but like it's something that I try to think about and do whenever I can. And when I need to just get quiet.
Yeah.
I'm terrible at it too, right?
Both of us, like, talk way too much to be like, quiet for very long.
That's right. And when you're sitting there and you're trying to be quiet and you get like an itch on your nose, right? And you're like an itch and you're like, don't scratch that itch. And I was like, what are you supposed to do when you have these like something physical comes up? And they just said, and the instruction is always just observe it. Oh, my nose is itchy. I don't have to react to that by scratching it. I can just observe that it's itchy. And, like, that's kind of my strategy when I'm on vacation and I'm trying to shut it off. Like, I see it. I know that it's happening. And it's going to take a lot for me to, like, react to it. But it's okay if I, like, send an email or a response. But it's just like I'm observing it. I'm not scratching it all the time.
I think there's aspects of that that are super useful in life. Maybe eventually I will get to a place where I embrace the meditation, but it has not happened yet. I like yoga.
Yeah.
I like that stillness that is required and the concentration, but I need to be multitasking. I need to be getting a workout while I'm doing that.
Well, you know the thing about the yoga? It's too long, okay? So it's like, you know, an hour and a half, and I'm always like about an hour in. I'm like, you know what? I don't know. Can we get
I do sometimes feel like I need to get – first of all, I like the napping at the end. That's great. But I do sometimes feel like I need to move faster through it because I got to get back to whatever I'm doing. And then that reminds me that I should be able to allow myself like an hour or 90 minutes and not be like freaking out about what I'm missing. All right. So
but
let's get back to –
Just stop break out. Just observe. Don't it. Just observe.
Yeah. Well, we don't really – and this is a different conversation for another time. We don't observe as much as we used to because we have the world in our hand and we can read and look at anything and we don't really just watch and observe. And there's some interesting conversations to be had about how that stunts creativity because we don't let the world influence us. We basically are just ingesting other people's takes all the time and then not coming up
all the
with
time.
This original way of looking at things as they pass us by. But honestly, that's another
Sarah,
conversation.
When I'm writing, people ask me all the time about, like, writing deep dive stories, right? How do you get really deep on something? Like, when you've spent time with an athlete or you spent time immersing yourself in somebody else's world and you need, now it's time to write and make it good, right? I actually physically have to go someplace. Like, I can't keep my phone on. I can't be engaged. I can't read stuff. So I can't even be home. So I go to, like, a hotel and just be there. Like, I just have to stay there and, like, be immersive. And, like, Kevin Arnold is telling me this thing, and it's like, oddly intriguing to me. He has this friend who, like, I guess he books passage on a ship. Like, when he wants
a
to write
ship.
A book. Like,
an actual boat. Like, he goes out to sea.
An actual boat. Yeah.
That's like, well, I mean, we heard a lot of people that go to, like, writer's retreats. They go to some cabin in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and I like to know that I could turn on the TV if I need to, but when I'm at the hotel, I mostly don't. The only time I leave is if I need to go get some food or, like, walk around the block just to stretch my legs. But that's kind of like, you know, to do long form well, and I know all my other writer friends have different strategies and everybody has different ways of doing it. Some people like to, you know, relentlessly outline. Some people like to talk it through a million times. They do 7 drafts. Like, I have to just, like, go and immerse myself in the story. And then I get super weird and method actory about stuff. Like, I ask people, like, what songs do you listen to? I'll get, like, a playlist for every story.
Oh, really?
I
can't listen to music when I write because I sing along or I focus on the music. I found an app called Coffitivity, and it just has the background noises of a coffee shop. It's like mumbling and some clinking cups.
Oh, that's good.
And it's really, really useful because it's not the silence that gets you and it's not the music that you sing along to. It works out well. Anyway, I should get paid by them because I mention it a lot. It's like it's super clutch. All right, back to Stanford. Okay, were you anything while you were in state? You were at the Stanford Daily, right? That you were spending some time doing some writing?
There. Like, I didn't take it too seriously. And then I got I did an internship at Sports Illustrated for Women. And the woman there, at the time, her name was Sandy Bailey. Now she's Sandy Rosenbush. She works for us, and she's one of the pioneers of this industry. And she was, I feel like she, like, plucked me from having a totally different life. Like, if she wouldn't have chosen me for that internship, I think I would have done something totally different with my life. Like, it was a really formative experience, but also, like, it really meant something to me that she chose me from all the other applicants, because it was like the coolest internship ever, right? It was Time Inc. And they used to do stuff where you got rooms at Columbia all summer. Like, you just, like, got board, you know, like, you got a salary and housing all summer. I know, right? And, like, like, nobody ever does this anymore, right? So not only did you get paid, not a lot, but, like, whatever, you're 21, that's fine. And you got to live on the Upper West Side with a bunch of other interns for free. Like, yeah. Okay.
That's crazy.
Right? Like,
Interned at Jim Henson, I at least had to find a housing in L.A., so I lived in a frat house for $300 a month.
Right.
This internship was awesome. Was good beyond the fact that you got to live in New York for free and hang out.
Yeah, I mean, it was also, like, I wasn't really ready to be a grown-up yet. So I went there, and I kind of got to, like, observe it all, and I was so into being an athlete, like a student and an athlete. I didn't really have an identity yet. I didn't really know what I was about or who I was. And so I was just, like, kind of trying stuff on. And that's not that I didn't take it seriously. I just wasn't ready to be a grown-up yet, I guess. Like, you know, not sometimes, like, people are already, they're, like, a junior year of college, and they're just, like, thinking about their next job. You know, they're thinking about how they're going to get a job in 2 years. And I was like, not ready for that yet. Like, I just wanted to, like, observe it. And so I don't think I was the best intern. I think I just, like, showed up, and I was, like, watching everything and reading stuff. But, I wasn't all super go-gettery. You know, I think I was, like, more excited that, like, I got to go to the cool office and, like, and the Time Life building. And, like, you know, they had all these opportunities for me to write. I don't think I took many of them. I was, like, I look back on it going, it's not an auspicious beginning to the career. But
yeah.
It was also, like, it was exposure, really.
Like, what did you think you wanted then? Because I think that, you know, a lot of kids that I – not kids. A lot of young people that I talk to now are so set in what they want that they don't allow themselves the time that you gave yourself to observe and just be a part of things and see. And I found that was incredibly useful for me. I wanted to do HBO Real Sports.
Me too.
After I stopped my dream of doing Second City and Saturday Night Live, when I switched to sports, I was like, oh, I would want to do the long-form stuff, not the nitty-gritty. I don't want to do radio. And I love radio now. So what did you think you wanted when you started, and how did that evolve?
So this is going to be like a very strange answer. I had absolutely no idea. I didn't want to think about what I wanted. I was like very childlike. Like, I didn't really want to grow up. I wanted to hold on to being a college athlete for as long as I could. And I wanted to just go off to Europe and, you know, travel around with my friends for a while. And like, it was sort of like you go to Stanford and you're supposed to be this big achiever. But I think so much, I was really in the moment. I was just like really there. And I didn't have these big goals and dreams yet, which is like weird to say right now. But I look back on those times and I'm like, I'm really glad I gave myself that space, though. It was almost like my big act of rebellion. It was like I was graduating college and didn't even have a job lined up.
Right.
You know, and then there was like I didn't want to. I just wanted to go to Europe and deal with it later. And I think a lot of that was because I had been so highly structured that I hadn't given myself the mental space to really think about it. And when I did think about it, nothing felt as cool as being an athlete. Like, I loved being an athlete.
When you say
I
structured,
being on the team.
I hate to interrupt, but you're saying so many fascinating things. When you say structured, do you mean as an athlete? Because I would imagine that there's also the opposite side, which is a Stanford All-American academic kid who's got an idea in their head of, I need to be at this job at this time at this whatever. And you sound like you were in the opposite place. So how do you think you balance being this like highly overachieving type A with that like being okay with not knowing?
Yeah, I think I like a little bit of it was hard. I was super angst-ridden.
Oh, so you were worried about it. You were worried. You weren't
totally
just,
But I was worried that I didn't know. Like, I was worried that I didn't know, and I thought that I didn't want to grow up, but I didn't know what I wanted to go be, and I hated that people were, like, forcing me into this, like, you got to stay on the treadmill. You're this big achiever. You got this big Stanford kid. And, like, and I was like, is it okay if I don't know what I want to do? And I was a little, like, rebellious, right? You know, can I have a couple of years to figure this out, you know? And I think a lot of it was like, okay, so when I say structure, I just mean, you know, when you're a college athlete, that means you spent most of your high school and junior high years even going to tournaments every weekend forever.
Yeah.
And being
and your schedule
focused
is
on
crazy focused.
And schedule. Yeah, like I didn't have a lot of time to like goof off and act stupid. I mean, if I did that, I was rebellious against trying to send me down. So rebellious against know what I wanted, but I didn't want anyone to tell me that I should know, right? And a lot of kids that go to Stanford, like they're just kind of on one treadmill and go to the next one. Like you're on the like treadmill to get into Stanford, and then you're on the treadmill to like go be a doctor or a lawyer, or, you know, be high paid consultant or whatever it is, a business shark or tech, you know, tech maven or whatever. And I was not like that at all. And I remember the first couple years out of college, like, I mean, I came home and I just did a lot of things that I'd never done before. Like I took like classes at UCLA Extension. I took a class on TV writing from my mom, who is like a really good writer, and she used to write scripts for cartoon shows and movies.
She was a professor,
like that. Like, no, not a professor. She just taught her own class. I took an acting class at UCLA Extension. I took a TV writing class there. I took all different things.
I took TV writing at UCLA Extension too. Sitcom writing.
I wonder if we were in the same.
What?
Maybe we were in the same class.
I'm guessing you'd remember me, and I would have remembered you as like, God, that girl talks so much. Stop answering all the questions.
True. I mean, I think I just had to.
We would have been best friends. Like,
yeah. So like, I'm trying to like think back on like those years. I really was like beating myself up. Like, oh my God, I went to Stanford. I have a master's. What am I doing with my life? I'm like living at home with my parents, and I made like no money the first few years out of college, right? And you know, I was just sort of like, but I also just I wasn't gonna just rush into some big corporate job because I felt like, you know, I was living up to something.
Yeah.
I remember my friend, her name is Sarah Beeson, now her name is Sarah Anderson, but she said to me, she goes, look, you can't steer a boat if it's not moving. And I was like, okay, I like that. You know, she's like, just do what you do and do what you do and you'll find your way. Just keep doing stuff. Keep trying stuff. And I was like, I really like that. Like, so I had to keep doing it, even though, like, I'd go to, I remember when I finally got a job at the Daily News in LA, I was covering press, and I'd go to, like, my old high school and cover high school softball games, and it was like, oh my God, like, talk about, you know, humbling, right? Like, you're covering, like, the sport you used to play on this very field 6 years ago. And, right. You know, you've gone off and you were supposed to be some big, you know, hot Stanford kid. Because there's this sort of, like, Stanford exceptionalism. Like, you're supposed to be,
for
like,
sure.
a big success story. And if you're not, like, you're a big failure. Because, like, oh, you have the advantage of this. And how could you not make it worthwhile, right? So,
yeah.
I don't know.
You know what's funny?
You
just reminded me. I was going to my five-year reunion at Cornell. And I literally wrote a blog about what a failure I was. And I might read that at the end of this podcast because I do tell people sometimes it's hard to put yourself back in the mind space you were in at that moment because there is such emo. Everyone right out of college is so, oh my God, how am I going to change the world? I'm never going to make it, right? And then when you do make it, you're like, it's hard to remember how desperate it felt.
It felt so desperate. And I would like, I remember it was like so hard because I had a job, I got a job with this producer in LA. She was like a family friend. And I was mostly doing like, I was helping her do treatments for her TV projects and stuff. And it was exciting and interesting. I think I was just like mostly like into being like a grown up and having a job and whatever it was. But like, I didn't want anything too hard because I'd just done really hard and highly scheduled for a long time. So I would do her projects and we'd do PowerPoints or this or that. And, she'd go pitch them and then, you know, the networks would say yes or no, or maybe. And for the most part, they said no. And I was like, ooh, you know what I don't like about this? That we do a lot of work in this and then we might get into it and then nothing ever happens. So I need a job where things happen.
Right.
I need a job where I write something and do something and there's an actual product at the end that goes to print. And that was when I kind of found my way back to journalism. Like that's how I got back into, you know, working at, the Daily News and just like it sort of felt good to do a story and have it be printed.
Yeah.
Right. Like,
well, and that's one of the interesting things about like learning what you like to do most and then what you like the results of. Like I like doing feature stories, but you spend days, weeks, however long for something that could be 4 minutes and you cut all the babies on the way. Oh, that was a great joke. That was a good line. That was a great interview. And with radio, there's just so much space. And I think that's one of the reasons that I like it, even though I was always scared of it. All right. So you take the path of a lot of journalists. You start in smaller places. You get bigger, 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 which brings us to ESPN. And this is the good stuff that I really want to get into with you because I'm fascinated by this with everybody. And you're a great person to ask about it.
Mm-hmm.
I have never, because I did not have a traditional journalism background, and I consider myself an entertainer who dabbles in journalism, right? Sometimes I'm doing journalistic work. A lot of the times I'm entertaining by having takes and opinions and whatever else and informing.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to investigative reporters and beat reporters, how do you go about becoming a scoop getter? How do you become a Ramona Shelburne and Adam Schefter where you have all of these contacts where they're willing to share them with you, where you know the give and take? Like, can you give me an example maybe, and you don't have to use a name, but of the evolution of a relationship and when you knew when they were feeding you something that you needed to report for their benefit and when you get stuff from them for your benefit and, like, how that genesis begins from just meeting someone?
How that goes? Well, okay, so let's go back to like, okay, so ESPN LA, I get hired. I was at the Daily News. I was the lead columnist there for like a hot minute. You know, I just got that job and then ESPN LA opened up and I left. And so I didn't really get to be the columnist there for too long. It was maybe like less than a year even. And so I thought I was coming to ESPN to go be a columnist. Like that's what I did at the Daily News. Right. And I get here and I realize that there's actually not that much room for columns, right? Like the guy who was covering the Lakers, he was writing columns off the game. The guy who was covering the Dodgers was writing columns off the game. And so I would come in there and they didn't need three stories off the game. They just didn't need another column. And it was a take and that there's plenty of takes out there. And so it was almost a survival strategy. Like the best columnists, I think, are the best reporters. And so when you do a column, you get people to talk to you and then you write it as a sort of a featureized column, but you know what you're talking about. Like you shouldn't write something unless you know what you're talking about, like a strong hot take. Like if I want to go rip the Dodgers, if I want to go rip the Lakers or, you know, get into something, I want to have an informed take. And so a lot of the stuff that I was that I would have written as a columnist or written in column form, it just wasn't gonna break through because it was such a crowded landscape. But when I would do the reporting, I could turn it into news, right? Like Mark Stein was one of the first people who taught me this. I would get all this stuff on the Lakers, and he was like, "Why are you putting that in a column?" He's like, "That is absolutely news. You got to write that as news." And I was like, "Really? How do you do that?" And I would call Mark when I would get stuff, and he would say, "Do that as news. Like, here's how you frame that." And I'm trying to think of like the first time I would really do it. Like sometimes it's an exclusive interview and you write it as a news story. Other times you would write it as a, source story or whatever it is. But I guess like, I'm trying to think of like the first name, if I can tell a story of like a name and how do I disguise it or something of like, so I don't out of
source. Right, I don't want you to give away. So the magic
that
you've worked to create.
I know, those types of things are for life, right?
Yeah.
Like Off the Record doesn't have a statute of limitations, right?
So, right.
You know, but I think a lot of it was just, it was a sort of an adaptation that I made of like, they didn't really want columns, or I'd write a column and no one would notice it. And Mark was like, if you write that as news, it'll get picked up everywhere. And, you know, some of that's just other people's reading habits. Like people click on headlines, not columns anymore. So I just started doing news. And then all of a sudden, like SportsCenter would call and say, do you want to come on and talk about the news that you have? Or do you want to, right? And then if you're okay and you are able to speak on television, like they call you again. And then they understand that you have like sources in and around the league that you can call and check on, and you can meet people. But like, you know, Mark Stein was always this guy who I would just call him relentlessly and just say like, hey, I heard this, what do I do with that? And he helped me figure out how to make it news, right? Because I think people don't understand this sometimes, like news, yeah, there's transactional news and that's just the news. Okay. It's, you know, this is what's happening and this guy signed or this guy got traded or this guy got fired, whatever. But a lot of news is just the frame that you put on it. There's a lot of news and feature stories. All the feature stories I get, if you want to just pull nuggets out, you can put a headline on it and it's news. So some of it is just having the mindset to think that way. Okay, you know what? Here's a good one. I was doing a story on Phil Jackson, and it was early in my time at the Daily News, at ESPN. Let's say maybe 2010, and the Lakers were going to the finals, and we were going to get a big story done. And I remember I'd never met Jeannie Buss before. I knew her, but I was a little scared to talk to her because she's the owner and she's Jeannie Buss or whatever. And Steve Springer was doing a book with her called Laker Girl, and I said, Steve, do you think you could introduce me to Jeannie, because I really need to talk to her for this feature I'm doing on Phil. And he goes, yeah, I'll walk you over there. I'll introduce you. And he introduces me to Jeannie. I sit next to her, and she reads the media. She reads stories. I guess she knew who I was a little enough to know that I was with ESPN. I didn't have to like give a whole bio. And she starts telling me, she's like, well, you know, if Phil's not back this year, I don't want our relationship to be an impediment to him going anywhere. Like, you know, Linda Rambis is my best friend and her husband is coaching in Minnesota and they make it work. And so I don't ever want our relationship to be a reason why he doesn't coach someplace. And I remember she said it to me and I was like, wait, I'm sorry. What did she just say? That's like super newsy. Like that was like a big story. And I remember calling Mark Stein and he was like, whoa, you got to write that, man. Like, and it was almost like I didn't deserve the scoop, right? Like I hadn't earned any trust with her to get her to open up to me. I think I just caught her at the right moment. And maybe I just asked the question the right way, or she knew that I was on to something, and knowing that like Phil was in a place where I think his contract was up, or her father hadn't renewed him yet, or whatever it was. And I kind of had the foresight to ask. I just asked the right question at the right time. And she told me, you know, that all this stuff, it was all on the record, and I wrote it up. And I think it might have been like the first time that I wrote this really newsy story. And my instinct as a newspaper reporter was, oh, make sure you go back out there the next game and say, thank you for opening up. I hope you feel like I was fair in how I handled it, right? And that was sort of how she was like, yeah, that's fine. You know, you did, that's what I said. And you understood what, you know, like it was, but like my instinct is always like, you know, how do you build trusting relationships? Is you're accountable.
Yeah.
You write something, you do something, you like show up the next day.
And but also there was like a luck really, involved, right? I don't want to say luck, because I'm sure that there is something about your manner and your way of doing things. In fact, Mark Stein, there is a story about you in New York Magazine, and You know, Mark Stein said you have a rare combination of a relentless reporter who likewise has the gift of making people so comfortable that they open up. Shelley Smith, she makes people really comfortable really quickly and they suddenly want to tell their life story. Windhorse, Ramona has this incredible ability to disarm people. But what is that? I mean, I've always thought that ever since I first met you that you were super easy to talk to and get along with and everything else. Is that something that you notice in life? Or simply in this job? And is this something that you honed over time? Or is that just your natural way of being and it really complements this job?
I think it's just my natural way of being. Like, I'm really good on bad dates, right? When I was growing up. Like, okay, yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Like, me too. Like, and I leave and I'm like, that was terrible. Seconds. And they're like, let's go out again. I'm like, yeah. Oh, no, I was having a miserable time. You didn't know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? But there's like, even when we're not having a good time, like, or even when it's like not a match, like, we can keep the conversation going,
oh, yeah.
Right? And so.
Yeah.
I think it's just kind of how I am in real life. Is that I think the essential quality, honestly, Sarah, is like I like people. Like, you know, people, right. Like there's some people who get energy from talking to other people, and there's other people who are like, I just want to go home, turn off my phone, and never, you know, just watch TV.
Yeah.
Like, please don't talk to me. I get energy from talking to people. I'm curious about people. Like, I just, I find them interesting. It's not fake. Like, you know, maybe we're on a bad date, but I'm still, there's part of me that wants to find you interesting. And once, even if I don't like you, I want to find.
Right, why you're curious.
Like when I wrote about Donald Sterling, I mean, I wanted to know more. Most people was like, I don't ever want to talk about that guy again. No, I want to know more because I want to know what it is about that guy. Like there's some, even if I don't like you, I still am interested. Does that make sense?
Right. Like, yeah, absolutely.
You know, I don't really get to the place where I'm done with you or I'm saturated all that quickly. And like, I think, you know, like empathy goes a long way. Like, being genuinely interested in somebody goes a long way, being a good conversationalist, but really just like listening, playing off of what they say, like, you know, obviously like having an idea of like when you talk to somebody and you have a sense of who they are and what they're about and what they're concerned with or what they're, you know, what they're nervous about or, you know, and we all have our lines whenever we try to get people to open up and talk to us. Like a lot of it is just having read enough about the person to where you know there are spots where it's going to be tough to get into and you know the spots where like you could start and they get you and they vibe with you or they don't, whatever.
Right.
But I think a lot of it is like, one, do your homework, and two, just put yourself in their shoes. Like, how would you feel if I'm asking you about something that's like super uncomfortable for you? And you know, how do I get into that conversation? So I know this must be hard for you to talk. Like, okay, Dan Gilbert, you could do a story with him. And, Windhorse kind of set me up. He was like, okay, here's how you go talk to Dan Gilbert. So stand right here and he's going to walk through here and you're going to have like 3 seconds to talk to him. And you got like, it's like I felt like it was an elevator pitch, right? You know, the famous elevator pitch. And you just got to go with it. You know, you just got to go like, hey Dan, I'm Ramona with ESPN. I'm doing a big story on you guys bringing that, you know, Cleveland's kind of the center of the world. Like, you got the Republican convention coming here, the finals are coming here, and I know you were right in the middle of it. Like, how did you pull that off? And it worked, right? So he was like willing to talk to me, and we went and sat and talked, and I go, look, you're super easy to caricature. You're the guy who wrote the Comic Sans letter and with a Napoleon complex who yells a lot, and, you know, like people don't like you, right? Like, they have that, and that's always going to follow you around, but you've also... One, LeBron came back. Two, this team's in the finals for the second year in a row. And
right. You spun it to a how did you pull this off versus a
right.
How did it feel when everyone hated you?
Right. And it's just sort of like, and you have to be real with them. You know, I think people understand that, like, it's not going to do you any good and it's not going to do me any good for me to just write some total Homer story. It's just not. I don't do that. Like, you got to tell the truth about it. But if you tell the truth and you actually let me see you, I've found, and this is the one really good writing class that I took, and I want to just like shout him out with a name because I steal his line all the time. But when you really get into the guts of a story, when you get real and honest with, even if it's kind of an ugly look and it's kind of a embarrassing thing, like if you're super honest about it, people don't see you, they see themselves. Like,
right.
You know, you and I were talking and like, I was like, yeah, I wasn't really all that good of an intern. I wasn't really into it. You're like, totally, me too. I had no idea. You know, we all relate. We're all human. We're all stupid. We're all late. We're all frazzled. We're all this. Like, just most people don't cop to it. So, like, you know, and when
you disarm people with that for sure. But there's, I'm interested, you know, when you're once you've gotten a couple people to open up to in a way that maybe you don't expect, and that's just by your nature, and people are willing to talk to you and kind of open up, you've established yourself as someone who has done long-form profiles of some really flawed people and some very interesting people. How do you now approach new people? I'm sure they have a certain level of respect for you and the work that you've done because you're fair to people, even people who, by simply being fair and telling the truth, you're revealing them to be deeply flawed, that they might still just think, she's trying to get in on something and I don't, I'm blocking her before she even gets a chance. How do you deal when you come in with a reputation of doing these very incisive pieces?
Yeah, like, I mean, we all have stories that we're trying to land. Like, I haven't landed a few of these also because I don't think either they want to tell that story or they want to give me control over it, right? And I think, like, you know, Serena Williams, I've always wanted to do a story with Serena, but she's got to want to do it. Like, it doesn't work unless you get there. And there's going to be a point where maybe maybe she'll get there, you know, but there's also, like, she can do great stories in Vanity Fair and this and that, and where she doesn't have to get into, like, the super deep primordial, you know, guts of a story or herself or whatever. Like, not everybody wants to do that. And I kind of get it, you know, like, I don't know if I want to get into the, like, the really embarrassing stuff that I don't want anyone to know about me. Right. You know, like, we all have that stuff, you know? So yeah, there's some people who won't open that door and there's some people who will open it, but only a certain amount, you know, like Kobe was one that took me a really long time. And I don't know if I all the way got there. I think he still got a lot more story to tell. But there's certain walls, like, you know, it's like they'll let you get in through layers, you know, like, okay, you can go to level 7, but not all the way to the final level there. Right.
Right. But you still got so far with him and
yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because with somebody like Lamar Odom, there's a different kind of trust there.
That's right.
From anyone that you talk to, not necessarily maybe the women of the Bunny Ranch, but any family members, anyone who cares about him. This is someone who's on the brink of death that needs to really trust that you're not going to take it in a gross direction or manipulate it. Yeah, or use it in a way that's unfair and sensationalized and forgets the humanity in it. That's tough. How do you do that with a situation like that? Or with Kobe? I mean, there's a lot of things about Kobe that people love, and he, in a lot of ways, surprises me with some of the stuff that he says and does that's incredibly empowering to others. But when it comes down to it, there is still something that happened in that hotel room. And as honest as he seems to have been, in the end, he said essentially, I thought we were having consensual sex. I realize now that her impression of what was happening was not the same. So something happened there. And you think about that as you're working with him and talking to him and telling his story. How do you do that with people like him and Lamar that are very clearly, or Donald Sterling for that matter, who have done or said things that are beyond reproach?
Well, the Kobe thing is that's a good question. And it was harder for me to deal with because he has a non-disclosure. So like there's a big area where you just can't go there. Like he can't talk about it. Like you can ask, but he can legally cannot talk about it. And so I don't think it's a secret. I mean, obviously people know that, it's a hard thing to talk around because you feel weird talking around it. And you feel like there was this one part where he got very raw with me about how horrible he felt about what he had done to Vanessa and the kids, you know, and like how much she like just hated his guts and threw all his stuff in the middle of the road in the middle of this. And there was a part of me that was like, yeah, that's the fallout that you have, okay, with your own family. But also there's a young woman involved here who we've never heard from because she signed an NDA too. And so it's hard to deal with, right? Like you can't tell the full story because you don't know the full story. You have ideas of what you think happened. I will give him credit for saying, I don't think other people have even gone so far as what he did, where he apologized to her. Have other people who've been accused of what he's been accused of, like, have they even gone that far? I remember.
Right. He's been more honest about it than I would say most who have been accused of that. Other than I would say.
But it's really hard. You know, we don't know what happened. Like, flat out. Right. Like, I've heard things.
Well, in his, you know, in his police transcript, he was incredibly open about things. Yeah.
Yep. And the judge report. And, like, I read all that. I read it at the time. I read it again before I did the stories. Like, it's like, it's hard because there's a part of me that goes, all right, I am filtering everything through the way I'm going to write it. I have an idea of what the story is. I try not to judge people because I'm not them. I like to write things so that the audience can judge them. Does that make sense? Like, you know, but I think you can always tell how I feel. Like with Ronda Rousey is another example of like, she was doing some stuff that I think a lot of people didn't like. I mean, she was talking to media. She was like walled off and she was, you know, and I was like, and I would always say to her, like, you don't want to talk. You know, I understand that. And she was sort of, she felt very exploited by the media and the paparazzi and this and that. I'm like, but you also created that, right? Like you created that buzz. And so now you can't get mad that, you can't get mad that this is the dark side of it. Right. So there's that part. So I'd call it out in the story. I call it out to her face. I say it. I don't ever write something I didn't say to their face. That's how I can look myself in the mirror and know it's okay to write that.
Right.
But with Kobe, like what you said, like, you know, it's a really good question because I could not even ask him about that. You know what I mean? Like legally, I could not ask him and legally, I could not ask the woman involved. All you can do is read the police transcripts and how they are. How do you handle that? Like, I don't know. Like, how do I?
Well, and also, how do you, I think, you know, a lot of people playing. We see actors who play the villain and they say that they can't judge the character they're playing because how do you imbue it with a sense of humanity and with a sense of a full rounded character if you are judging them? It feels to me as though in your work, when you do Around the Horn or when you do other stuff, you have opinions and takes and stuff, but you're not really someone who judges or puts much of, You represent things fairly, and then you let people get what they will out of that representation. Do you think that that's sort of a requirement of what you do, in that you will then still have access to people, and that you will, that you will never be judged as someone who doesn't present it fairly because people will presume bias? Like, I know that happens for me sometimes because the stuff that I do is very much, this is what I believe, and this is my opinion, and this is what I get paid for.
Yep.
Yours is less that and more, here's the facts. I'm not going to judge them.
Yeah.
And then you can't think that I'm biased in the way that I present them to you.
Right. Like, I think that, like, you know, and it's hard. Every story is a little different. Like, you know, with LeVar Ball is another one. Like, I have to tell you, you know, I have to give you enough that you could, I think if you read it close, you can always tell what I really think. I think if you know me and you know what I write, you can always tell. But I feel like it's really, I'm presenting this for you, the reader, to be able to judge. Like, I still come from that old school newspaper side where I give, you know, much information. And so I remember talking with my editor, Raina Kelly, on the Kobe stories, my really wonderful friends in this business and just brilliant, brilliant woman. And she's at the Undefeated now. And we talked a lot about Colorado and the rape and everything, you know, the rape accusations, sorry, I should say that. We talked a lot about how to treat that and how to handle that, because I felt very strongly that we have to address it. Any story that purports to be some kind of, you know, Kobe definitive, like, end of career story, like, that's, you know, within the first two sentences of his, like, of his career epitaph, right? If you're going to write this story, you have to address it. You have to do it in a meaningful way. But I also don't know how he can comment on it. I can tell you what happened. I can, you know, you use it in this. And she and I really struggled with it. We really went back and forth. And I think that's the section we spent the most time on, of how to handle it. And I think I wrote it very plainly and let the facts tell the story. And then I had that, you know, the thing, the personal fallout that he is able to discuss. And I felt like he talked about that in a way that was, I'd never heard him talk about Vanessa that way. I mean, he doesn't really go there with his relationship with her. So I don't know that I have the right answer on it, Sarah. Honestly, I really don't.
Well, I mean, a lot of it is just feel for you. It's not even that it's intended. It just becomes, you've learned the ways to do things over time. I wonder also, you know, one of the things that I think can be a beneficial in some ways to women, and this is a generalization because everybody's different, and also be difficult, is I've certainly had some guys open up to me because they feel like either they want to talk to me because they just think that I'm like fun and interesting and act young and whatever. But then they don't get into nitty-gritty X's and O's because they think I'm not going to get it. So I'm limited because I don't get the stuff I'm looking for sometimes. But also, there's a lot of judgment about stuff. If a male reporter becomes close with a athlete or a GM or something and they go out golfing and they go grab lunch, no one cares. When it's a woman, there's this judgment of what's she doing and how'd she get there. And, you know, there's so many other layers to that. So Do you find that you've been treated any differently at any point in your career early on or now than the male reporters that are trying to go after the same scoops and covering the same teams?
Okay, so the answer to that is, yeah, I've had guys hit on me and all that stuff, right? But I'm going to say this is like a weird thing, but I feel like you and I can talk about this. So I think it matters that I'm not a skinny girl. I think it matters that I'm not like some super hot chick that when they talk to me, they're not immediately going into the, like, do I find you attractive or not? Like, I don't think I put that out there, okay? And I'm not saying I'm ugly or putting myself down or anything like that, but I'm not like, you know, like I'm on television and I can talk and I feel fine about myself, et cetera. But I think it matters, like, just like, I think how you look matters, right? And I'm not some skinny girl or I'm not some, you know, traditional standard of television excellence, you know, or whatever you want to call it. And so sometimes it doesn't like, it doesn't signal to like, they're not in this place where they feel like they have to like, their relationship is always affected by attractiveness. Like we talk more, like it's almost like an asexual relationship.
Right.
It's an asexual conversation. Like I'm very feminine and I'm very, you know, I have a feminine perspective. I'm very womanly in that way, but it's not sexual. And
right.
I think because there's never that tension in the room, it just doesn't come up much. Like, I know that sounds weird. It just doesn't. Like, we don't have a little flirt. We don't have I'm like an old married lady, you know? Like, I just, like, you know what I mean? I'm like, and I think that,
is shitty because you are a beautiful woman and that's not part of your job description. But in some ways, you could be right that it's beneficial. I mean, I can only imagine the number of people that a Carrie Champion or an Erin Andrews approaches that never even let them get to their job, that don't give them the respect. I mean, we just saw Marshawn Lynch do an interview where he approached a set without, you know, an official interview going on and spent the entire time with the woman asking him legit questions instead of asking her out.
Yeah.
And that prevents you from doing your job. And everybody can laugh about it and say Marshawn Lynch is funny. But she didn't get any of her questions answered. And you're going to laugh and you're going to play it off because it's awkward and it's weird.
Yeah.
And if it looks weird for you to be like, Marshawn, that's disrespectful, then everybody hates you. Oh, lighten up. So then you end up not getting anything accomplished. So while it's shitty, I guess you found a way to make it work for you.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I feel like I can be honest about it. And I think it's like kind of a weird thing. Like, have I had guys hit on me? Like, people I cover hit on me and make inappropriate comments. And Twitter's made that a lot more awkward too. Right? Because people can just like DM you and you're like, oh God. Right? Like, I don't even know you. And now I have to let you down easily. And, you know, like, I don't do that. And thank you for being unflattered, but I don't do that, you know? I mean, it's just sort of, you know, that Twitter relationship now with all these, you know, that's accessible in a way that they would never do that to you in person. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
But,
well, and that's the trick is you actually have to be good at playing the, I'm just joking this away, because otherwise you'll never talk to me again and you won't give me any information because now I've made you feel bad about your fragile masculinity and your, you know, by rebuffing you.
Yeah. I mean, I usually have like a standard line is like, you know, hey, thanks. I'm super old married lady. You know, can't go there, but, you know, good looking out, you know, like
my
like
vagina literally doesn't work. I've been married for so long. Yeah. It's closed up. It's cobwebs.
Yeah. But it's interesting. Like, you know, who is like a great person to talk to about this. And like one of my favorite mentors in this business is Jackie McMullen, man. I mean,
she's fantastic.
She's such a badass. Right. And like, you want to talk about like, is it hard to get guys to respect a female journalist? No. Look at Jackie Mack. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, she was Jackie Mack back in the day when there was only one of her. You know, there's really, like, now there's a few women in the locker rooms all the time, and guys are used to us being in there and talking, and they're definitely used to us being on TV and having opinions, and Jackie was doing that a long time ago.
Yeah, they put the groundwork in for us. Well,
So,
I mean, I think that's a really interesting take and a really interesting approach. Does it work the same way with... in terms of your coworkers, because when I was early on in the industry, someone said to me, like, don't worry so much about the athletes. They'll probably be fine. You're going to have more trouble with fellow reporters. And that has been true. I've been treated well by pretty much every athlete I've worked with. And I've had plenty early on, not lately, but plenty of early on experiences with other reporters that were not good or people in the industry. Do you find that if you're the only woman on a beat or if you're around that you miss out? Like, are they going to dinners without you? Are they getting scoops without you? Are they doing things that you're not invited to?
Yeah, that always happens, and it's going to keep happening because it's like dudes want to hang out with dudes, you know? Like, there's just like a lot of lonely nights on the road where it's just like me, and, you know, I end up just like going to dinner by myself. But, you know, I'm okay with that. Like, it's okay. Right. I'm busy, and you know, I'll order something up in the room. And
you're at dinner with the sources they're trying to get.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, is that, like, you're right. There's like definitely in baseball, I felt that earlier in my career. I had a lot of like bad experiences covering baseball where like the writers were super chummy, and like I was this like alien who talked a lot, and they were like, don't you know we're just supposed to stand here and not talk for 3 hours and watch that guy throw a bullpen session, you know, I mean, like like why, who are you? I mean, I'm like an alien to baseball writers, so like they just, you know, they're like, dude, shut up. Right? Can you imagine you and me at a baseball covering spring training?
Yeah. They'd be putting their headphones in. I really have to listen to this call. It's really important.
Yeah, right. I mean, so like, I remember they'd all like go out and I'd be like just home in my hotel and just, you know, it was just like, hey, the spring training, you're supposed to have fun. Like, I don't know how to do it. But like later on in my career, I look back on those days and just be like, yeah, they sucked. I'm okay. You know, I don't need to deal with that. Because the people who are the good dudes, the like highly, the more evolved ones, like, they're the ones who are going to be successful anyway. Because they don't, yeah. Like, I always think when people are afraid of you or if they're, they don't know how to relate to you. It's like, now that I have some confidence about me or now that I've established myself, like, it bothers me a lot less. But back in my early 20s, mid-20s, when I was starting out and I didn't have much, it's not just confidence, but I didn't have much experience to stand on. It would bother me. I have this thing, like, why don't you like me? How come you don't like me? There's nothing wrong. I'm really nice. Why don't you like me, right? And like,
right. You know? Let me be like, a part of the club.
What am I feeling? Yeah, come on. And now I'm just like, eh, screw them. Right. You know, like, who has time? And so it's I think that, you know, some of the guys who were the best to me, I mean, there was this guy, Vinny Bonsignor. He's a columnist at the Daily News. He used to cover me in high school, and that's how I got, like, my first internship at the Daily News, like, and so Vinny would come to spring training, and I would always, like, wait, Vinny, when are you coming, please? Like, all these other guys are so mean to me. Right. Nobody talks to me. And then I would show up with Vinny, and we would, like, ride together. And, I, you know, spring training is, like, really early in the morning, right?
I'll just, yeah, you always need a wingman. Right? That's the key.
Yeah. And there's, like, one guy who opens the door for you, and then everybody else is cool. You know? And so, like,
yeah, it's basically pickup basketball. It's like, somebody needs to show up with you that's good and be like, I'm not playing unless she does. And then everyone's like, all right, she can ball. That's basically all it is.
So, yeah. And it's so like, in my career, like, there's, I would have shit, like, the guys that I know, like, Elliot Keyford was this guy in the NBA. He was a beat writer for the Lakers when I was at the Daily News. And he was cool. He'd always make sure I was invited out or I wasn't just, like, sitting alone in my hotel room. He would invite me out. And then everybody else was like, oh, you're cool. Or not, and they talk about me behind my back. But anyway, right? Like Kiefer was great, and like now, like Lee Jenkins, Sam Amick, you know, like those guys are all like they're just like these highly, they're evolved males, you know, and they invite us all out, and like, and now it's not a problem, and we, you know, I try to make sure that happens to the younger, you know, journalists coming up, like they, you know, somebody reaches out.
Yeah, now you get to be the one who gets them on the court like that. This is going to be a longer podcast than usual. I'm going to keep you for another couple minutes because you're fascinating. And then I'm just going to have you back again soon because I have so many other things to talk to you about. But one of the issues that I have is when there's a story out there and I need an opinion, I'm fearless and I don't care if people disagree, whether that's, you know, things that are hot button like Colin Kaepernick or smaller level, they shouldn't have traded for this guy or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But I'm usually doing that from a place that's incredibly principled in that the story's already been broken, the facts are out there, and now I'm giving you my opinion.
Sure.
I always think that it would be for me, and this is a flaw and a weakness of mine, very difficult to break news that would hurt somebody. Even if it's true, even if they're a bad person. If I had the news that someone was taking I almost said STDs. That would have been very weird if you intentionally took
that
STDs.
That would be hard to take
It would be hard to take them and then just inject yourself intentionally. PEDs. Yeah. But if I literally walked into a room and Chris Bryant, the biggest star in Chicago, was taking PEDs, I would tell someone the story. I would do the story, but the fact that I knew that I was hurting somebody and drastically changing the arc of their career, even if it was their own fault, would be really hard for me. I have a tremendous amount of empathy in a way that would be really bad for me if I needed to break news. If it's out there, I'll react to it. And I'll be fair, I think, to the person and what they deserve. But how do you do that? How do you...
Yeah, okay.
Even
so
if you're being
you
fair,
tell you about,
how
like,
do you do that?
When you do something that's super awful to somebody and you know it's really hurting them?
Yes.
Okay, so let's go back. Mike Brown was coaching the Lakers. It was his first year coaching the Lakers. It was the lockout year, 2011. I'm out on the road with him, and I guess it was maybe March. And team is just not feeling it, okay? He's been there. He really hasn't had a long time, but he's following Phil Jackson. He's a very different style. You know, I remember this is the part where, like, you know, you could tell that they're just not digging him, okay? They gave him a couple months. They're not digging him. They don't necessarily respect him in the way. They weren't playing very well. They, you know, I'm on the road trip where they blow two, like, 20-point leads and lose both games back-to-back. So everybody's upset and, you know, sniping at each other and this and that. And that's, of course, when people talk, okay? And they vent to reporters and they, you know, you write stuff. And, you know, my job is to write the truth about why this team is losing. I mean, this is, like, a really good team. They should be winning. And they have – this is, you know, a year when they have, you know, an incredible team. And they're not coming through at all, okay? So this is going to suck for Mike, okay? The story I write is going to suck for Mike. I know it. But it's my job to, you know, to write it and be honest about it. So I spent that road trip knowing I was doing it. And then there was a couple people who opened up and confided in me about, like, what the actual issues were. I just remember, like, one player was like, we were, you know, we were playing one team two nights in a row on a back-to-back, right? And it was a home and away back-to-back. And they had, like, a three-hour shoot-around on the second day of that back-to-back. And this was the one where they had to travel. So they're literally playing the same team that they played the night before, flew to the next city, got up, had a shoot-around. And first of all, you never do a shoot-around on the second night of a back-to-back. Not only do you not do one, but you don't do a three-hour one. And you definitely don't do it against a team that you just played. And so, like, if you want to, like, alienate veterans pretty quickly, that's probably the way to do it. And, you know, people were upset. And I just felt like I had to get as many viewpoints as I could. And I had to, like, try to ask the right questions, and then I wrote it. And I, you know, I think the story was, like, you know, Lakers are questioning his X's and O's wherewithal. And, like, is he the right guy to follow Phil? They were, like, secretly meeting, talking about the running the triangle again. These were, like, people who – there was a time when people liked running the triangle offense, right? So I think I even had one player say to me, look, playing for Phil is like getting a PhD in basketball. And it doesn't mean that Mike Brown wasn't a good coach. It just means that Phil Jackson is a really tough follow. And the guys playing for him that year were just, they weren't ready. They didn't buy him yet. They didn't buy his gravitas. They didn't buy his basketball expertise. And you're trying to convince them to run a different system. In a year, and quite frankly, the deck was really stacked against Mike. I mean, it was the lockout year, so they had to cram everything into a couple months. But, you know, I had to write that story. I had to tell the truth about where the Lakers were and why they weren't buying into what Mike Brown was selling and why the team kept losing. And I wrote it, and I remember, like, realizing, like, I felt like I was, you know, assassinating somebody. I felt like this is probably the end of his tenure in LA, whether or not he gets fired right after this or shortly thereafter. Like, this is a really damaging story, and the only thing I can do, though, is, you know, it's not me deciding that Mike Brown is a good or bad coach. It's me reporting what people on his team are saying about him. And so, do we have a choice in whether we go after stories? Yes. But do we all, that's, you know, the only thing I could really think of is, okay, this is what's happening with the team, and the only thing I can do is show up the next day and make sure that I'm not running from it. I didn't just, like, fire a bullet and run away. Like, I, you know, you stand there right in front of the guy and you let him yell at you and you let him talk to you and have his say. And I remember going to practice, like, we flew to Minneapolis and I saw him, I think it was a practice the next day. And I was like, Mike, you know, we should have that land. You know, I'm sure you probably aren't happy with me right now. And he goes, well, you know, I saw it. And he goes, I just don't know, you know, why you let people who are unhappy about playing time, you know, influence a story like that. I'm like, yeah, you know, it's, I don't think that was the motivation behind it, and I can't reveal who I talked to, but the people, you know, obviously I talk to a lot of people before I write it. And, you know, I want to be able to, like, be open and honest with you without betraying sourcing and stuff like that. But I felt like we had a really good conversation about it. I felt like he was clearly not happy with me. I'm sure he, you know, had a lot of words with his agent about me before that. And I feel like he'd probably, I found out later the Lakers had a big team meeting about it, and it was all about, like, not talking to reporters and keeping things in-house and being upset. If you have something to say, say it to us. And, you know, obviously that's a lot of what happens to a lot of teams when stuff that's in the locker room gets out, but there's a reason it gets out. And it's because that's what's actually going on. And that's why the team is losing. And that's what's going on inside that locker room. And so the only way I can sort of make my peace with the idea that you're writing stories sometimes that are very damaging to people is, like, you just have to be a grown up about it. It's like, and you know, like, you show up, let them yell at you, let them talk to you. If somebody was writing a story like that about you, wouldn't you want them to pick up the phone and, like, you know, like, and have, let's open the door for
have
you to have your say, or open the door.
Yeah.
If they want to yell at you, if they want to be mad, go ahead. If they want to be a Scaramucci on you or something, right? Like, they should be able to do that, you know?
Then just make sure it's on the record and then print it.
I know, right? By the way, I've been yelled at by plenty of PR people.
Right.
Go on now.
But it's never prevented them from giving you access?
No, like, that's their, like, I feel like you're not doing your job if people aren't mad at you sometimes. You know, like, if you haven't, like, the only thing is they can be mad at you. Like, Stan Kasten, he's one of my favorite guys to do it because he's just sort of been through it all. Like, in basketball, NBA, I mean, sorry, basketball and NBA are the same thing. He's sort of been through it all in basketball and baseball and all this other stuff. And so we've definitely had our arguments. And I remember one time he calls me up and he goes, I forget where we left off. Was I mad at you or you were mad at me? And I go, I don't even remember, Stan. He goes, all right, whatever. Like, it was sort of like, I mean, that's just kind of part of it. Like, if you're always, like, making nice and making sure everybody's happy, and that you're probably not doing a very good job, right? But as long as you're fair with them and you're not, like, a total wuss where you write stuff and, like, never show up the next day, like, or you don't give them a chance to respond, like, people don't do that anymore, and that used to be, like, standard practice. It's like, no matter what you write, even if it's somebody you don't, who's going to hate your story, you're supposed to get a chance to comment before it comes out.
Right.
You're not supposed to blindside people. That used to be, like, standard operating procedure, and nowadays, like, people just report and throw stuff out there without even checking with anybody. I mean, it's just...
Right.
You know,
well, that's interesting, because I think that there's certainly elements of journalism that are still standard practice, and that's the way you need to do things. And then there's elements that have been massaged a bit by the changing times. One of those, and as I mentioned before, I didn't go to journalism school, so I learned all this on the fly. But, you know, it used to be don't make yourself the story, and it's not about you, and blah, blah, blah. And at this point, and for some people, not for the Schefters of the world, but for some people, you have to make it about yourself, because there's so many people out there presenting stuff that you need to give people a reason to get it from you, right? It's and so, you know, you have to figure out as you're coming up what kind of journalist you are, what kind of rules apply to you, what kind of rules don't. And that must be tough, I think, for both you and athletes and teams to sort of continue to evolve along with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because I wear a lot of different hats, right? So when I'm around the horn, I have to have a take. I have to tell you what's happening. And, or when I'm on SportsCenter, like, you know, nowadays we give a little more opinion as opposed to just, like, straight reporting of information. And we have a little, or at least we give a little more personality. And I think my general threshold is is this something I would say to their face?
Right.
Right. If you can.
Right.
I mean,
which is basically being fair. Right.
Yeah.
That's it. Am I being fair?
Am I being fair? Like, if I say something and then it's replayed for that person right to their face, like, if I just hit replay of that podcast of Around the Horn where we ripped so-and-so or whatever, right? And then the next time I saw them, we opened the podcast, we played it for them, they heard it, and they were like, ooh, okay, really kind of roasted me there. How would I feel? And I think it's a pretty good standard of, like, you know, if you could just be, like, a grown-up and stand in front of them and be like, yep, that's what I said, I meant it. You know, like, do you have anything to say to me there? Do you have any reaction? I'll take your questions, or I'll take your, you know, like, I'll take your mooch talk, you know, like, whatever you want to, right? And, like, I sort of, like, I don't know, I think that's a great standard to use. Like, if you're not, like, those of us that came up to the industry, that was, like, like every veteran newspaper person like ingrained that into me. I remember like you, if you write a negative column, you better show up the next day, you know? You
well, and that's why,
in the
you
of the
know,
locker room and
without using names, there were fights between those who, and one particular reporter in Chicago who wrote columns and didn't show up every day.
That's
and
right.
Then his colleagues at that newspaper had to show up every day and not get good access because the people would say, I don't want to talk to your paper. And it's interesting, and this is a topic for another time, but, you know, in the layoffs at ESPN, I think it's worth noting that ESPN is in a tough position of understanding that people are looking for certain bylines and opinion givers because that's what draws them in. But the information that fuels the gas baggers like me comes from people who are there every day. And you need those people. And people might not notice who they are, and they might not be on TV as much or even on the radio as much giving their opinions, but they're providing the information and making the relationships. And without that, we don't have anything to blab about. And so
there's
a real balance there that's necessary. And without you and the Woges and then the lesser known people who maybe don't get the around the horn gigs and the Sports Center gigs as much, we're left with a lot of just guessing. And we need that information to get us in the right track. And so that's a really interesting balance in today's sports world that we know what sells, but we also need to buoy that with substance.
Yeah, and I think that, like, you know, I've always got, you know, it took me a minute to, like, figure out how to walk that line because sometimes I'm really in reporter mode and I'm just trying to present the facts so that you read the story and you, the audience, get to judge. Sometimes I'm in columnist mode, like, and there used to be a little more church and state. Like you didn't switch sides, you know, and I used to adhere to that a little bit more before I was on TV or radio or whatever it is. And like now, you know, I think there is a little more pressure. Like sometimes people will say, how far can you go in pushing that? What do you think is going to happen? Or, you know, just in terms of giving takes or this or that. And I come back to the same thing. It's like, it's not going to look good if I'm going to try to be some, you know, super hot take artist now with things, because that's just not me. Like there's certain people who are great at the black and white, you know, and there's other people who find shades of gray very interesting, and I'm more of like a shades of gray context person and depth and this and that. So when I'm on Around the Horn, I may not get as many points sometimes for like a, you know, quick whatever, but I hope that like sometimes when I'll go and give a nuanced answer, or I'll give you like the sort of media politics answer, or the, like, you know, not media politics, but like, this is why this week came out. This is why
coming from a space of knowledge and experience.
Yeah, and so like that's what makes the show good, though. Too is that we all have different point of view.
Well, yeah, you got to bring that because I'm not there. Like that's not part of my job. And if I was supposed to be there, I wouldn't have time. I'd have to give up some other part of my job. And so I take all the information you get, and then I'm responsible for the sarcastic one-liners because that's my wheelhouse.
Right.
And your wheelhouse is going in and getting the meat. Well, I could talk to you forever, as is clear from this podcast. And I can't talk to you anymore because I've got to go and you have to go. So next time, which will be sooner rather than later, I'm going to put you through the Spanish Inquisition, and we're going to get to all the other questions that I have. But I'm glad we got through this because these are some of the questions that I'm always fascinated to hear about the behind the scenes. So we'll get into more of that next time, too. But for now, I will release
you. I'm the only one who – I think I actually came closer to getting both of us in trouble than you did. That's like – usually when I'm on radio with you, I'm like, oh, my God, one of us is going to drop an F-bomb.
You're worried.
Which one?
You're worried. I've never dropped an F-bomb on the air unless you count a joke I made about Doug Pfister that did not go over well with the higher-ups. That did get me dumped, but that's a story for another time. Thank you, Ramona. Love you, Ramona.
Thanks, sir.
Oh, and another thing.
So this is slightly different. That's what she read for this week, because Ramona talking about the angst that she felt being a Stanford grad and competing with people who seem to have everything figured out reminded me of a blog post that I wrote. And I have this old blog from way back in the day. And this was not that long before. This is actually now a little bit more than 10 years ago. This was before I moved back to Chicago. And it was time for my 5-year college reunion. I've just revealed my age somewhat, and that's terrifying, but that's fine. And I was writing about how in a couple of weeks I would be heading back to Ithaca to go to Cornell for my 5-year reunion and be surrounded by people who were probably engaged and had, you know, portfolios to be managed and great jobs that they'd been, you know, prepping for their entire Cornell career. And all these former valedictorians and honor rollers and scholarship people would be there talking about their great houses and cars and jobs. Meanwhile, I was out in LA, barely scraping by, trying to do something that I loved. And I believe at the time working at Fox Sports Net behind the scenes as an associate producer on a show there. Here is a little bit of what I wrote. I'm giving myself a pre-union pep talk, Jack Handy style. I imagine it will go a little something like this. Sarah, you're good enough. You're smart enough. And doggone it, people like you. Your LA lifestyle is fun, exciting, ever-changing and evolving. You don't have set vacation days or even set work days. Sure, your salary is laughable and the chances of succeeding in your chosen career are 1 in 3 million. But life is all about fun, 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 right? Yeah, you can barely afford the flight back to Ithaca to attend your reunion, but once you get there, think of the stories you'll have to tell everyone. Parties with movie stars, lazy weekday afternoons spent drinking poolside at a hip hotel, spur-of-the-moment trips to faraway concerts and sporting events taken without leaving an out-of-office message. You don't even have an office to be out of. Ha ha! Youth, life, passion. Sure, each and every workday is another 8 hours on autopilot without any given task requiring more than 1% of your brain. Fine, your heart is deflated each time you see someone on television, in a magazine, at an audition, doing what you should be, could be doing, but aren't. But hey, you've met David Hasselhoff. You can wear jeans and a Cubs visor to work. Ha ha. You scoff at the thought of business professional attire and 7 a.m. alarm clock settings. You're wild and free and living the dream. Okay, so no one thought you'd be this poor and unaccomplished by your mid-20s. Yeah, maybe you're a huge disappointment to your parents, who imagine they'd be done helping you pay your bills by 26. But look at the great, big, wide world laid out in front of you, waiting to be shaken and moved and changed. You could do it. It's not too late. Just because most people in LA your age have already hosted a few shows, signed with an agent, written a touching memoir, dated a soap star, made a sex tape, shot a bikini calendar, and consistently spend more money per week on blow than you do on rent, doesn't mean you're a failure. Hey, get back here. Come on, don't cry. Listen, you haven't even slept with anyone influential yet. I'm not saying you should. I'm just reminding you that you haven't really put your whole self into this thing. Give that moral compass of yours a little directional nudge. Go out to dinner with that creepy producer. Roofie yourself, wake up in the morning remembering nothing, and watch your career begin to soar. Hooray! Vacations in Aspen and red carpet arrivals, interviews with the QB in the locker room, and nationwide book tours. That second home in the south of France, there. Feel better now? Good. Now take a couple of those diet pills and get to the gym so you can make it to LA tan before they close. No one's going to care how funny you are if you're fat and pale, Sarah, especially the rich, successful, well-adjusted people at your reunion. So there you go. A peek into my mindset at 26. I always say it's hard to remember what it was like when I was making zero money and didn't know what the heck I was going to do with my life and wondered if I would ever make it. So there it is. That's what it felt like. Keep your chin up, kids. It'll all work out. And thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.
That's what she said.